especially in the West, we have developed quite effective and successful systems how to deal with abuses of power. Once we look, you know, outside, yeah, out of the Western world and see what it means if you are society, nation, community, yeah, whatever, lacking, you know, sovereignty, and then you have to see it, you know, from the perspective of imperial abuses of sovereignty. Yeah, sovereignty is important. Yeah, it's important. I mean, it's important that it's not abused, but it's important that it's equally distributed in the world to prevent the interventions of the outsider.
Here is the new Berlin.
Here is das neue Berlin.
Hello and welcome to the 72nd episode of Das Neue Berlin. If you think of the new Chinese and Russian interest over the lithium reserves in Afghanistan, the Egyptian outrage over the Ethiopian dam project, or the struggle over the oil fields in the Antarctica, it becomes apparent that natural resources are a common object of international conflict. This isn't a new development. It has been the case for at least 500 years, and regarding the ongoing climate crisis, those conflicts are likely to intensify. In this episode, we want to think about natural resources, their global distribution, and the question of justice. Today's guest is Petra Gümplowa. She's junior research team leader at the Collaborative Research Center Structural Change of Property at the University of Jena. Her research focuses on the rights over natural resources, their historical genesis, and the normative question of justice. Petra, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
Petra, as I said, your research cycles around natural resources. Why are you interested in them? What is special about them? Why are they so important to understand central conflicts of our presence?
So yeah, it's true. For several years, I've been really into natural resources, and I guess that my interest can be traced to at least two things. Yeah, I mean, I was researching and I was working as a PhD student. I wrote my dissertation about sovereignty. Yeah, so I was really interested in the concept of sovereignty, and also how sovereign statehood functions in the international system. And and then when at some point I noticed that there is this really neglected area, which includes the fact that sovereign states also have these quite encompassing rights and privileges over their territories and natural resources, and nobody seemed to be really concerned about that. Yeah, I mean, the way we speak about sovereignty is often how sovereigns relate to one another in international relations, and how sovereigns and governments who claim sovereignty then deal with their populations, or whether sovereignty lies with the government or with the people. Yeah. But this material aspect of what sovereignty in contemporary world implies has been completely neglected. It's been completely neglected in political theory, but also in legal and constitutional theory. I mean, as you know, constitutional theory is very much concerned with how to limit sovereign power, but there is just absolutely no discourse about how to limit sovereign power over parts of geographic space, yeah, or what limits rights of sovereign states over natural resources. So this is one thing. And then I was also very interested, and I've been really interested in philosophy of justice, and in recent years, natural resources have become I mean, they are now considered a very important distributive good. In other words, philosophers really now look at natural resources and they think about how important are they from perspective of distributive justice and what are the applicable principles of distributive justice, yeah, how we distribute the most important natural resources. But I noticed that the main feature of how philosophers talk about natural resources is that they always develop like an ideal theory of justice, for example, such that is based on demands of egalitarian distribution. And then they see what would be the implications in the real world. Yeah. And for me, this is not a methodology that I'm comfortable with, because I think we have to look at the conflicts first. And then, consider how the involved actors themselves, what they see as a problem, and how to correct these most critical conflicts of our time, rather than to, you know, philosophize about some ideal conceptions of justice and then see if they are applicable to real world.
You have a very interesting combination of historical analysis of the international rights system, and you combine that with a normative approach with philosophical questions about what can we understand under the term justice, for example, especially in relation to natural resources. I asked myself, why don't you restrain yourself only to the historical analysis? Why do you think it is important to also include this this philosophical analysis, this normative approach? Maybe you can tell me more about this very special combination of research approaches.
First of all, I think I have to say that I was always attracted to political theorists or philosophers call normative theorizing. Yeah, so I really like I like to make statements about what should be. Yeah, what is the ideal state of the affairs. Yeah, and I also like very much critical inquiry. I really like examining determining what's wrong and why it's wrong and what kinds of harms there are, and you know, to be naming those kinds of conflicts and harms, or in other words, engaging in critical analysis, is something that I also like very much. But so I think the role of philosophy here is philosophy has an important role to play to provide the kind of moral language that we need to make sense of what is wrong with reality. Yeah, but I think that philosophy should do this in ways that that those who are, you know, who are participating in those conflicts, those agents to whom, you know, who are parts of those conflicts, who live with the all kinds of negative consequences, abuses, violence, and so on. Yeah, they have to be able to identify their senses of injustice, you know, with how with the answers that the philosophy provides, or the visions that the philosophy provides. Yeah, so this is something. Something that I call, or philosophers call, this practice-based normative theorizing, yeah, which is formulating some normative conceptions, but very much trying to, stay within the existing institutions, and also not to go too far from the language that that the involved agents themselves use. Yeah, so that's one thing. Then the historical The historical is also very important for me, and I think there are also a couple of reasons for that. I think one reason is that I, you know, throughout my research, I came to realize that natural resources are an extremely important dynamic element, which accounts for it accounts very much for the history of international system itself. It can, you know, it explains many forms of colonialism. It explains so many conflicts and global histories. Yeah, it can. Claims what kinds of resources, how economic and political institutions were developed to control those resources. This is really behind many global systems that we have in place today. Yeah, like I think the international system itself, the fact that it's a system of sovereign states and that sovereign states control territories and they try to control even, you know, more territories, they expand into global commons and so on. This is really explicable by, you know, trying to control natural resources because they are such important goods and assets for humans. Yeah, so the history really is interesting for me because there is whether you look at from the perspective of conflicts, whether you look at or patterns of conflicts, or whether you look at from the perspective of the institutions that we have in place, you know, there is a meaningful history, and there is continuity in history. So understanding where we are now really requires understanding the past.
One last abstract question. You consider international law as a central element in, for the historical explanation for current resource injustices in our world. Of course, this genesis of international law is deeply related with the history of colonialism. I ask myself, is the international law that important in this historical complex, or is it just one aspect of many? How important is international law to understand this whole historical process? Is it central, really?
Well, I think that I think international law is indeed absolutely crucial. Yeah, because international law redescribes the evolution of the international system itself and the emergence and the development of international system itself is a development of systems of control over territories, people, and resources. Yeah. So, since this is such a dynamic element in human history, modern human history, let's say, yeah, like the history that started with in the age of discovery. Yeah, this is really like one way how to look at human history. Yeah, dynamic system of expansion, discovering new frontiers, but that always comes with the motivation to get control over territories, assets, resources, and people, and impose some systems that enable specific agents, yeah, like kings or trading companies and so on, exclusive control over these assets, yeah. And so international law was developed to really, manage those kinds of processes, to make sure that those processes are smooth as possible, that conflicts, violent conflicts and wars are avoided as far as possible. I mean, of course, they cannot be completely avoided, but But since there's always conflict over who will control what kinds of assets and resources, you need certain rules of the game, yeah, that enables the game to continue, yeah, and to go on. So I think international law really captures, you know, this kind of specific dynamic through which we can understand the modern history of humans, yeah, which is to dominate, to control, and to you know, assure that there is exclusive access to some resources, and that these once those systems of exclusive access are established, then that they are protected by certain rules of the game.
So the just to recapitulate, so the argument is that colonialism is not just like a system of violence, of arbitrariness, of despotism, but it has those rule-based systems in it, and it only can work through law, through those philosophies that also come into play. You need to understand it, even to be able to criticize it in a way.
Yeah, I think you could say. I mean, the way I see it is that I see, first of all, in my understanding, or this is not just one way of looking at it, but I think in important respects, it's important to recognize that colonialism was not so much about civilizing mission or spreading Christianity and controlling people. It was about controlling territories and getting exclusive access to valuable natural resources. And of course, controls over populations and political domination over the people came as a consequence of this, or at least we can say that it came hand in hand with this. Yeah. And because colonialism was pursued by several European powers at the same time, yeah, they, I think, really needed to manage the rules of the game of trying to get access and control over territories and resources. So that's why they developed these rules that historians of international law call them these first sets of rules, call them law of nations, yeah, which are these rules of the game that the first centuries of international law comprised. Yeah, so it was a rule-based game in any case. Yes.
Yeah, maybe we can have a closer look at the three law principles you especially identified as very important and significant for the whole process of claiming ownership to natural resources. You identify three historical principles: the right of conquest, the right of discovery, and the right of the freedom of the seas. Maybe we just start chronologically with the first one, and of course with a very interesting context of Spanish early colonialism.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I think this is such an important principle that today it is no longer valid. Of course, yeah. Today, you cannot. It is not possible, or it is not considered legal in the international legal sense to conquer foreign territory and then keep it and then, claim legitimate sovereignty over it. I mean, not that it doesn't happen. It happens. Yeah. I think the annexation of Crimea is exactly the kind of case. Yeah. But, then many states do not recognize Russia's valid claim of the Crimea. But in the past, this was not the case. Yeah. Like military intervention or military campaign, or war was considered a legitimate means how to either extend the territory or acquire new territory, or how to impose political sovereignty over the people in really like distant parts of the world. Yeah. Like, I don't know, like the British did in India at certain point, like the Dutch did in East Indies, like the Spanish did over the Inca and Aztec Empire. Yeah. And why I think this is really important, yeah, because this really shows us, on one hand, that territories and territorial control in so many instances in the history really originated in these kinds of acts of violence, yeah. So I think it's important for us to see that in general, you know, territories of sovereign states are really were created throughout history by these extremely morally arbitrary means. Yeah. So the fact that states even control specific territories, like the concrete territories that states control, it's an outcome of this extremely problematic historical process. I think on one hand, it gives us even on like the most basic sort of moral or philosophical level, it gives us ways how to question, the fact that, I don't know, country like Democratic Republic of Congo or country like United States or, you name it, yeah? The fact that such country controls specific portions of the surface of the earth and has, claims over natural resources within it, that it's really like at the very core, it's a very problematic claim, yeah? And it can be questioned by others, and it can be questioned from some, points of global justice and so on, yeah? But the point I wanted to emphasize is that the reason why states, for the most part, imposed conquered foreign territories is that the territorial control and sovereignty over territory was the most efficient or effective available technology that enabled the sovereigns, to make a property claim over natural resources of those conquered territories, yeah. So I think if we look at the origin of this very, specific system that we live under today, yeah. And again, I repeat, it's the system in which states control territories, and not only control their borders and territories, but also have a property claim to natural resources within those territories. It really has to be understood in this very historical moment. Yeah, like I think Spanish conquest of Americas is like the first successful imposition of sovereign territoriality over large territory, which was motivated not so much by politically dominating the people, but to have control over silver and gold, which was located on that territory. Yeah. So if we want to understand why we even have, a system in which sovereign states make a property claim over natural resources, and why they can treat it, as their exclusive property, why they can use it to maintain power, yeah, to sustain, to stay in power, yeah, to use resources as a material resource for exercising power, then I think the history really helps us to see how it came into being and why resources are still so important, such an important material resource for the exercise of political power.
maybe this exceeds also your research, but is this like a new modern principle? I mean, if you look, for example, at historical cases before the Roman Empire, for example, I'm just asking myself, weren't the Romans doing the same thing, going to other places, claiming them, harvesting them, or did they maybe have another idea? And it was not like the modern legal idea of this is now a colony. Are there differences? Have you looked into these questions?
This is an excellent question. Yeah, I think you are absolutely right. It's actually not so much... it's not so easy to say that the early colonialism is a complete beginning of this. Yes, Imperial Rome can be characterized in these terms as well. Yeah, and especially... conquered territories and making then property claims over public and private property in conquered territories, and also making claims of property claims over mines and natural resources. But I think that if we really want to locate this as a rule of an international system, so control over territory always implies the control over resources, and that other players in the game also respect that. I think it makes more sense to speak about that only when the international modern international system emerges. I think in the ancient times it's a bit difficult to speak about international system, although somebody might disagree with me on this. Yeah, but I think that this becoming a sort of global rule of the game, I think then we have to locate it in the 16th century.
Maybe I can add another question on that. What does in the 16th century, 17th century mean the international system? I mean, there is not like a international courts and stuff like this. I mean, we don't have like a professional global class of legal scholars. So who are these people thinking about it? Is it mostly the church, or maybe you can give us an idea of what means these in these times?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, you're right that the institutions of the international system are radically different, or as you suggest, they were non-existent. Yeah, but certainly there is there are certain the rulers certainly had or felt a great need to justify their actions, yes, and they justify their actions in specific public fora, yeah, like and I guess you're right that many of those fora were related, you know, to the existence of Catholic Church and also through the work of important philosophers, you know, that have become influential in so far as their work was disseminated and quoted and used by the following generations of thinkers, yeah, like Francisco de Vitoria or Hugo Grotius. And so on, yeah. So yes, it was a very primitive system, but it was indeed an emerging system.
Yeah, I mean, in your one paper, you talk about this. I thought this was really interesting that, as you said, they needed those justifications and actually developed these theories why those peoples are part of the church or can be part of the church, and what this means for all kinds of other things. I mean, it's really surprising that you have... I mean, what I said before, you feel like it's just pure violence in this colonialism, but you also always have these theories.
Justifications. Necessity of moral discourse. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you ask yourself, like, why when you know, in the end, the most horrific acts of violence were considered permissible, or and people found justifications for them. But so in that light, I think the question, like, why people felt need to justify their violent acts is an interesting one. I'm not sure if I have an answer for that, but I think that, you know, political thinkers usually emphasize that no power can be sustained over a long period of time without some, you know, justification or invoking some moral rules, and I guess that's the reason why it is the case.
This is really this was also a thing I asked myself, and I also found very interesting. And I was just wondering, also, one could ask, in front of which audience you have to justify yourself. Is it the colonized peoples, or is it your people, or is it other colonial powers in the world?
I mean, one thing, if I can add this, in your text you wrote that this one text, Requerimento, Requerimento, yeah. And this one document, it had to be translated to the language of the colonized tribes or people, which I found really interesting. So you go there, colonize these people, but you give them like a written document in their language, so they can understand that it's totally legal what they're doing here. I mean, this is of course a bit ironic, but I mean, there has to be some logic behind it, why this has to be translated.
Yeah, this is interesting. I think like the justification vis-a-vis those who now who then become subject to domination was the least important. Yeah, and I remember reading a book which actually tried to, based on some historical accounts from the ships, to imagine how such a you know such reading of this document could look like. Yeah, and I remember reading that it was read, you know, in the darkness of the night by drunk, you know, sailors, and of course, you know, they had absolutely no concern whatsoever for the fact that the indigenous people did not understand the language and that they didn't even were notified to listen to this. Yeah. So I think this was the least important audience, but I think, yeah, the most important, justification or the most important function it had was to really, you know, manage the conflicts, yeah, over the conflicting claims by others over specific specific territories and places or resources in general, yeah. And I don't know, in case of Spanish conquest, it is known that already back then the Spanish conquest had internal critics, yeah. So probably the need to justify that to some, I mean, in a very limited sense, to some, you know, critical domestic audience, probably had some importance as well. But I think that the main addressees of those discourses and claims were others who might potentially, you know, claim or seek to control those people, those territories and those resources as well. Yeah. So, I think the main function was to avoid and manage conflicts between the colonizers themselves.
Well, then maybe let's move to the second principle, the right of discovery and occupation. Is it some kind of evolutionary process in which every principle is developed further, or is it just a complementary second principle in your perspective?
Well, I think it's different on quite a few levels. I think, like, on one hand, you know, once one kingdom or one sovereign, you know, manages to conquer one territory, you, if you're interested in that territory as well, you have like several options. Yeah, you can, you know, engage also in a very costly military campaign. And if you know that you don't have means to do that, or, you know that the, such a campaign would not be successful, you can either, you know, you can either contest that claim by on different grounds, or then go and seek out other resources and places and claim that you have right to them on a basis of a different kind of principle. Yeah, which is, I think, what British did. And they did it to challenge the extensive Spanish claims. I think they did not really seek to challenge the Spanish and their successful conquest of Mexico and Peru and so on, but they challenged their claims over other parts in the Americas, which the Spanish did not really manage to settle and occupy. Yeah, so the British with this principle of discovery and occupation, they invented a principle which basically said that if you discover something, and then if you manage to successfully occupy the place, and by occupying it means if you settle your people there, and then the people survive there, and they create a successful agriculture and you know, trading systems, and you create systems of governance, then this is what establishes the establishes the legitimate claim over that territory. So it was about settling, controlling the land, and putting the land in a productive use. Yeah, it's like the agricultural use of the land. Yeah, so this was not so much oriented to you know, conquest, because, I mean, for example, the British, when they arrived in North America, they were not really challenged by developed empires and you know, militarily strong empires. They just had to, you know, settle and survive, and you know, make sure that their settlements continue. Yeah, so this really reflected like a completely different, not just geopolitical situation and these kinds of geopolitical conflicts, but also the kind of, you know, socioeconomic conditions in that place. Yeah, so it's very much the principle that requires you to occupy in the sense of establishing civilian government and you know, producing something on the occupied land.
You also mentioned John Locke, of course, as one of the main philosophers who developed a certain legitimization of a property as in relation to work, I'd say, in the sense that you have some right to own something if you personally worked on it, made it profitable or at least fruitful in a sense. And then there's this interesting distinction, very typically colonial in a way, between, yeah, well, Western agricultural work, and then those tribes over there in the Americas who are only hunt and collect fruits or whatever. So like a very practical ideological construction in which a certain kind of use of soil is more civilized and more morally worthy than other kinds of uses, which perfectly then fits the interests of the colonizers. And this is I found this really a very also very brilliant construction they made up there.
No, I'm glad you noticed this. I mean, I have, like, in all honesty, this is not out of, this is not something that I this is not my original reading of Locke, but but the other fact is that this is still not a mainstream reading of Locke. Yeah, I mean, I was inspired by some thinkers, most importantly Barbara Arnail, yeah, who really did an amazing job to you know, look at, like, how Locke was engaged personally in the colonial enterprise, and really how she read in between the lines, and how she related this concept of you know, common ownership of the earth, and how Locke describes common ownership of the earth, and then uses you know, here and there references to how Native Americans or indigenous people of North America, how they live and how primitively they live, and how unable they are to establish economic systems, or how they are unable to put the land to productive use, and how they are unable to, you know, develop these effective systems of territorial control, and that's why, you know, their land is still sort of some you know, common, yeah, which is up for grabs for those who have, you know, who can put the land to the most productive use, yeah, who can plant, who can use it to produce commodities, yeah, basically, because this was considered the kind of labor which justifies the imposition of private property rights, yeah. So this is a really important point, that, like, not every kind of labor justifies the establishment or creation of property rights, but only such kind of labor that produces economic or monetary value. And this is really something that Locke, I think, had in mind. Maybe he does not express that, like, so explicitly, but it is in the text, yeah, in any case, yeah. So he is a very important philosopher who redescribes the process and provides an important justification for the foreign imposition of property rights over land, land which seems to be completely, you know, waste and unproductively used, and those who have you know, systems to use it productively then can go and take it, yeah. And this is, yeah, I mean, you know, going back to our discussion about, like, why this is important to look as far back in the history, I think this is really I think it helps us really understand, or gives us, you know, critical moral language for understanding current forms of land grabbing, yeah? Because it's very much the same, yeah? I don't know, corporations, agricultural, big agricultural business, or countries like China, you know, go and seek large scale land acquisitions in countries where you know, the governments seem unable to really, you know, to make efficient commercial use of the land.
You have a third principle, and at first glance I was a little not surprised, but I wasn't sure if I would put this principle next to the other two, because the other two are some kind of legitimizations of colonial land taking in a way. The third one, the so-called right of the freedom of the seas, is a little different than the other two. Maybe you can describe the context in which they this principle, this right, came into being, and why do you combine it, or why do you stress it in this colonial constellation?
Excellent question. I think that the reason why it's put on a par with those two principles is on one hand that you know, in the later centuries, like in 17th, 18th century, a new kind of commercial colonization was emerging, and the main agents of that colonization were these trading companies, like British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company, and then many other, and every country had its own trading company, and this is a form of commercial colonization that consisted in controlling the flow of specific goods, and imposition of trading monopolies on local traders. In other words, simply, you know, trying to control trade with valuable goods in certain places, So I think, you know, this form of trading, the colonialism by trade, like company coming somewhere and, you know, making the local traders to trade just with them and not to trade with others, on securing, you know, exclusive access to goods like spices, for example, this was the aim, the aim was not to to conquer the people, to establish political sovereignty, which, by the way, then often was necessary to maintain or to impose those trading monopolies. It was not also always important to settle the domestic people in those foreign places. This was really just about, you know, controlling of trade and trading routes. This is sort of equivalent to those forms of colonialism. But what is important is to look at what enabled this overseas trading system. And so if we, look at Hugo Grotius' work and the way he was a lawyer who was hired by the East India Company to justify the Dutch, have access to East Indies, and they can, you know, travel there, and they can also try to control trade there. So for him, like, the logically, if what was necessary was to maintain that there are certain geographic areas that they have to, you know, stay open for navigation, so that's how the principle of the free sea was developed, and argued for, to sort of think about the logistical conditions for these other commercial forms of colonialism, based on trade and commerce and monopolistic trading relations. I think what is interesting is to realize that this principle of free sea, which basically said that sea is a different kind of geographic space. It's not like land or territory, and it has to be open for navigation. It cannot be enclosed by territorial rights. It cannot be enclosed by private property rights. It really has to be like the open space of competition, where everybody has access, and then everybody on using that open global common space, yeah, can use to then, you know, compete here and there for the control of resources. But interesting is that this is like, unlike other these colonial principles, this one stayed with us, and we still have it in a contemporary world. I mean, we still large parts of oceans are still governed by this principle of free sea. Yeah, they are open access, and it's still a very liberal regime insofar as states or private companies have open access to these areas. They can, freely fish there. They can use the oceans for navigation, and so on. So this one really survived to our age.
I mean, you have these libertarian people who want to build boats and found new states in the seas that are not governed by anyone. That's really interesting. And one thing that just came to mind, I heard so many times that, like, in the age of piracy, the peculiar thing was that it wasn't actually illegal to be a pirate, and they were employed by the state, basically. Is this like an effect of the system? And I think it took quite a while before like the state said, okay, this piracy has to stop. I don't know if you know a lot about this, but this just came to mind.
These people were called privateers, yeah, and they were essentially, pirates in given contracts by the states, and their job was to attack other ships and capture the cargo and take the cargo, basically, and so on, yeah. I'm not such an expert on these practices, but I was just reminded recently by my own teenage daughter, who is very much in this hugely popular science fiction series. I don't know if you guys know this, The Six of Crows, and there's also this wonderful Netflix series about it, and there is a really beautiful, cool guy who is a privateer. Yeah. So recently, like, she came up to me and said, "Mom, could you please explain to me what is a privateer?" And, so it's exactly, but back to the question, I guess the point, or the implication of this is that, it's been really instituted as a lawless space. Yeah. Like a very radically, libertarian, like you said, a space where you're really free to go to access that space, and the rules are different. Yeah, it's really there are not very many rules. Certainly, the rules are different from what rules there are on within the states and among states on territories. Yeah, so. And I think, sadly, we live with the consequences of this extremely crudely liberal understanding of global commons, yeah, which is, I don't know if we look at high seas, but also if we look at spaces like the atmosphere or the outer space, that they really are still considered, spaces where anybody can dump pollution, yeah, waste, where you can, extract resources with no limits whatsoever, yeah, like fish, but basically no limits. Or, there are, of course, there are rules, yeah, but they, there's no elaborate system of enforcement of those rules, yeah. And, so it's still a system based on this principle of, this moral principle of first come, first served, who has technology, who has power, who has economic means, can just go and grab as many resources as they can.
I mean, I really liked your analogy with the free market, basically. I'd like to think there is this neutral space where everyone can lose, but everyone can win also. And sometimes, there are those imbalances and there are some pirates, but all in all, it's still a good principle. And is this also like connected in the historical text, or is this more like an analogy we see today? Or is like these liberal principles, this market principles, also explained in connection to the free sea?
As far as the question about markets, yeah, I think that I think it helps us explain the current dynamic of the conflicts over natural resources. You know, now I'm coming, so to speak, back to the beginning where, you know, where I said that there are so many conflicts over natural resources and the existence of markets and global markets and how toxic some of the markets are, yeah. Explain why, you know, we keep extracting resources in, I don't know, biodiverse hotspots and so on, yeah. But I think back then, in the early centuries of colonialism, markets were not so important. I think the importance of natural resources was geopolitical, yeah, like for a king, yeah, or for an emperor to control territory, its people and its resources, like meant an extremely important geopolitical, like it wasn't a geopolitical asset. It was not so much an economic, asset. It was not imposed for economic reasons. Yeah. Like territory, I mean, how big your territory was signified the greatness of your, you know, political sovereignty. But I think this is no longer important today. Yeah, I think global markets or markets in general, or marketization, commercialization, and commodification of resources is the most important and harmful dynamic today. Yeah, I mean today, countries do not seek to control territories, or they don't settle their people, you know, in foreign places. Yeah, they just make sure that they use, you know, market mechanisms to get maximum, you know, share, or you know, to get profits, and so it's a different mechanism, I think.
I also have another two questions about this right of the freedom of the seas. The one thing, I found it very interesting what you said about global commons. This is for me a very relevant and current problem with the question of commons. And there's also a line of thought who's dealing with exactly this problem. There's this term of the tragedy of the commons, which I think perfectly describes what you just said. This is a case where a common realm is treated without rules, without any concerns about consequences, and in an extremely egotistic way, because it is so important facing the ecological catastrophe of our century. Are there any normative principles in the tradition of international law, or also in the current international law? It's a little off topic, but that you would consider a good counterpoint to this tendency of the tragedy of the commons?
No. It's that is not like off topic at all, because like on not only this is like what I'm currently, you know, working on, so it speaks very much to my actual research, but it's also, you know, very much about you know, natural resources and justice in general, and the conflicts, and how we think about, you know, whom resources belong and who should use them, and for what purposes, who should control them, and what how should benefits be distributed, and what if somebody has power to control resources, whether we should judge that power, I don't know, for example, on the basis of how politically legitimate or democratic the power is. So all these questions are relevant for global commons as well. Yeah, I think that just to answer your question, like, first of all, I would like to say that tragedy of the commons is I mean, there has been a lot of criticism about this concept, but I think it does apply to global commons, and I've been using it myself very much. It really explains, redescribes what happens in global commons, that there are actors, agents who really pursue their short-term economic interests. They are unable to agree on rules of the game, and they are unable maintain or to respect the rules that they agree upon. And there's always someone who free rides, someone who ignores the rules, and there is absolutely no like higher authority who has power to enforce those rules. So yeah, it does. It's a plausible descriptive device to describe what happens with emissions, what happens with fishing, and so on. Yeah, but whether there are some alternatives available or some other inventions, let's say, in international law concerning the resources which are either, you know, located in domains which states simply do not control, or resources which might be located on sovereign territories, but our intuitive understanding simply says, wait, these are really like globally important assets. Yeah. Like, for example, like rainforests and biodiversity is a good example. Yeah. So I think, in all fairness, it has to be said that international law has developed quite a few, principles. And I would name, at least one, which I think is really quite revolutionary, let's say, and that is the principle of common heritage of mankind, yeah, which is a principle that implies that certain resources are a collective property of all mankind, yeah, and it means that it cannot be just those who are economically or technologically advanced. Those cannot simply go and extract those resources and use them. Yeah. If they do so, they have to comply with international rules, and they have to make sure that the benefits or the resources themselves or the monetary benefits that these resources generate really are globally redistributed. Yeah. And this system actually, is meant to work quite well. I mean, it's applied most efficiently on seabed minerals. Yeah. These are small potato-like, substances that you can find them on the deep seabed, which no country has control over or cannot really legitimately claim. Yeah, and there's a very elaborate international system with institutions and international seabed authority, which has quite a few agencies, and it has a mining code. It has developed a system of, you know, how licenses are allocated and how profits are redistributed and so on. I mean, the mining on the seabed does not occur yet, but it might in a very near future. So we have a system that at least partially will make sure that these resources are somehow, you know, there for the benefit of all. Yeah. I mean, how effectively this will be implemented, that remains to be seen. Yeah. But I think the fact that humans were even able, yeah, to agree that certain important economic assets might be, you know, collective ownership of mankind. It's actually quite innovative, given, you know, the long history of trying to secure exclusive control and access. Yeah, which is, I think, is like the dominating dynamic, you know, principle in modern human history. Yeah. I mean, there are also other principles that are a bit less observed, or they don't have such a sophisticated rules system. Yeah, like for example, the ban on whaling, for example. Yeah, which now seems to be collapsing because Japan decided to hunt whales again after decades of not doing so officially. Yeah. Then I think also sort of the continuous attempts to find out a global system of cutting emissions and, you know, find an agreement on limiting greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, depending on how you look at it, but I think certainly the fact that the last attempt to have the global agreement on how to mitigate or limit climate change, which now seems to have like a universal, you know, participation that all countries committed to reducing the emissions. This is also something quite unprecedented. Yeah, I mean, you can say this is not enough, and I agree. But still, like from the perspective of how international cooperation and how international law has worked over the centuries, I think this is at least from that perspective, it's a milestone.
My second question was about the specific aim you have with your historical analysis or this genealogy of these three principles, because it seems a little paradoxical. On the one hand, you want to use international law in a way also as a moral resource to extract some basic principles and to find a conception of justice that is implicit in our current international law system. On the other hand, you, when I understand you correctly, try here and this with this genealogy to show, in a way, the dirty roots of many of our of very influential laws and rights. Is that a paradox, or is it how does it fit together?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very challenging question. That's a very that's a very good question. I think that I have to answer on one hand by saying that I mean, international law, first of all, is a hugely incoherent system. Yeah, so it does include norms and principles that have that can be it themselves they can be used to sort of think about justice and improvements, like for example human rights, yeah, which I use in my work a lot. Like I really invoke human rights a lot as an important set of norms and principles, which gives us not only ideas about how states should govern over the people, but also how humans should think about governance over natural resources. But I think human rights also show that international law is not like I mean, we cannot see it as a sort of you know, coherent continuous system. Yeah, it has changed. And what main norms and principles the early law of nations involved, and then the positive international law of the 19th century, and the current international law. There are, you know, profound differences. I think especially after World War II, international law has undergone a profound transformation, and it now rests on principles which were not there before. Yeah, like prohibition of aggression, the fact that every state, whatever the state is equally sovereign and has equal set of rights, the fact that human rights are now considered to be obligatory for our countries, and so on. Yeah. So. But this was introduced only recently, and so the change is not only concerning the kinds of rules and norms international law now includes, but also how they are made. Yeah, they are made in United Nations, which is like universally inclusive organization. Every state is a member. Yeah, so the rules can be potentially made in quite democratic manner. Actually, yeah, but in ensuring large participation and deliberation. This is not how international law was made before. I mean, international law was made was like we talked about. Yeah, international law merely redescribed the interests of the powerful and what happened to be established as a rule of the game. Yeah, and then it became international law. Yeah. But this is now how it works today. Yeah, international law is created differently, and it does include principles of justice. Yeah, and also distributed justice, like for example, the Common Heritage of Mankind principle that I mentioned, which was created or introduced in 1960s, and it was made part of the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Seas in 1980s. Yeah, so it's very new. Yeah, so that's how I would explain the paradox.
Okay, well, maybe we can focus in the last part a little more on the positive aspects you can find in current international law, and your complex idea of a certain kind of justice over natural resources that you develop, I think, in combination of the right to self-determination and, on the other hand, human rights. Especially the first one, the right to self-determination, I think we have to explain first what does that really imply, and in which historical context it came into being.
That's a very important question, because I think it also goes back to what I have said at the very beginning about what kind of normative philosophy I'm interested in pursuing. Yeah, I'm gonna try to explain that really shortly, which I always fail, I think. But let me see. Yeah, so we discussed like the design and the contours of the colonial system, and if I just in one sentence, yeah, I think the essence of the colonial system was that it justified that only selected sovereign states or their trading companies, yeah, can impose rights over natural resources in foreign places, yeah. So this was basically the essence of the colonial system from the perspective of not just, control or domination over people, but control over resources, yeah? That you impose property rights over resources in distant places, yeah? This was, of course, considered hugely unjust, yeah? Once colonialism became no longer morally justifiable, yeah? In the moment where colonialism was illegitimate, completely illegitimate, yeah, and seen as a completely unjust system, then you have to recognize that not only the people, whoever the people are, yeah, like the communities, I don't know, states, nations, however you define it, yeah, they have a right to have their own you know, systems of governance. Yeah, they have, in other words, they have their own right to sovereignty, but they also have to have the right to control their territory, including, you know, control or even ownership of natural resources in their territories. And this is such an important principle, which then helps them to, you know, to prevent the forms of accumulation, primitive accumulation of resources, yeah, by outsiders, by, So in the process of decolonization, which consisted in two things, creating, you know, former colonies becoming independent, which meant that they are now equally sovereign like any other state in the world, regardless how big, how economically powerful, and so on. Yeah. So equal right of sovereignty on one hand, but also this principle of what is now in international law, it's called permanent sovereignty over natural resources. Yeah. So it was extra added, you know, to the privilege of sovereignty, to really that the state has the ultimate jurisdiction over natural resources, and basically like the ownership right over natural resources. So it came hand in hand with this principle of self-determination, which was in the process of decolonization, it was like invoked as the ultimate moral principle. Yeah, like the colonized communities, entities, they have a right to self-determination. Yeah, they cannot be colonized. Yeah. But as an implication or as a consequence, the self-determination meant also this sort of collective ownership over natural resources. Yeah. So this is how it came into being. Yeah. But I guess like my point, what I'm trying to argue for is that, We can you know, see self-determination. What does it mean for the people to be self-determining? I think a very simple answer, you don't have to be a political theorist, I think, to say that if a collective is self-determining, it might mean some basic level of democracy, yeah? Some basic level of, I don't know, participation, some, you know, basic civil liberties and political rights, and so on. Yeah. So democracy and human rights are really important benchmarks of what self-determination can mean in the practice. Yeah. And so I guess, what I'm trying to establish is the connection between, you know, what are the ethical and political principles under which we can say that the people are self-determining, and can we use the same principles to apply for how collectives like states, yeah, or societies, how they treat or how they manage natural resources. Yeah? So that's how I think the connection works, and how I'm trying to establish the links between those two principles,
between human rights and the right to sovereignty. Yeah, this is really interesting, because national sovereignty doesn't have a very good ring to it, yeah, at first, and most of the progressive people around, it's always a little fishy to make a strong argument for national self-determination, because, as you also pointed out, nations are quite arbitrary historical products, and we cannot presuppose some kind of ethnical or cultural collective that is placed on this territory, and then just say, okay, now you are you have a right to self-determination because you are a people. It sounds at the first glance very counterintuitive, and many, as you describe it, many theorists of international or global justice are just making the claim that because it is arbitrary, we have to find principles for redistribution avoid this necessary, undefendable distribution of resources for on different territories. We have to be universalist in some way to transcend this arbitrary and therefore unjust system of resource property in a way.
Mm-hmm. That is an excellent point, but I just cannot help it and just like comment on this. Yeah. I think that this makes me very upset. And I'll tell you why, because exactly. Yeah. Like people, some thinkers have a tendency to interpret sovereignty based on the experience of, authoritarian abuses of power on one hand. And on the other hand, exactly like you said, like not really being able to accommodate like the plurality in the society and the existence of minorities which might have like a different interest and so on. Yeah, but I think people who say this, I think this is a very limited view of what sovereignty does. Yeah, I think especially in the West we have developed quite effective and successful systems how to deal with abuses of power. I mean, constitutionalism, individual rights, that are entrenched in constitutions, and democracy help us to mitigate these potentially negative consequences of sovereignty. But once we look, outside, out of the Western world and see what it means if you are a society, nation, community, lacking, sovereignty, and then you have to see it, from the perspective of imperial abuses of sovereignty, and so try to speak with like oppressed people, indigenous communities, or societies that lived under centuries of colonialism and still have to live with consequences of this, and try to tell them that sovereignty is this bullshit, I think this is exactly, I think that many normative political philosophers, they tend to ignore those kinds of, how the oppressed people actually really like experience the oppression. Yeah, sovereignty is important. Yeah, it's important. I mean, it's important that it's not abused, but it's important that it's equally distributed in the world to prevent these kinds of outsider, the interventions of the outsider, the attempts to dominate by outsiders based on some dubious, civilizing missions and, ideas about supremacy of Christianity and ideas about supremacy of capitalism as an economic system and so on. Yeah. So sovereignty for those who historically were excluded from rights of sovereignty is so important. Yeah.
Yeah. What might change my mind about this, or when I started to think about this question, was when I read Imagine Communities by Benedict Anderson. And when I found out that he was actually an expert on Southeast Asia and talks about these processes of imagining a community to be sovereign and to kind of build their own state, especially in those countries that were before colonial states, and of the elites there, elites, of course, that came from the mother countries from England and from France and wherever, and then to think of themselves as we're not French anymore, we're not, but we're a different people now, or we're not. I mean, especially in South America, we're now Uruguayans and Argentinos and those new groups to become sovereign and to not be part of Spain anymore. This really changed my mind. Another question, maybe you could talk about some examples where this comes into play. Another example for me is, of course, Bolivia with Evo Morales, who has this very... this point, or always talks about this, that like the sovereignty, or from what I understand, is extremely important. But because if you're not sovereign and you have a corrupt government, whatever that exactly means, but in his case, it means you're governed by international corporations that want your natural resources, and you're exactly not a sovereign. So the sovereignty is really like a basis of all kinds of riots and properties of good living, of a good life. Of course, is in Bolivia something completely different than in Germany, for example. Maybe you also have some examples where this really comes into play and where we see your point.
No, you are absolutely right. I think the problem is that, in like the post-colonial sovereignty also was very prone to become the kind of sovereignty that we don't want to have. Yeah, like you have like a despotic, authoritarian government or some military junta that really, captures the power and then abuses the sovereignty privilege to get control over natural resources and I don't know, sell them and use them really like as if it were private ownership. I mean, there are countless cases, that people discuss. Usually, this is captured partially by the research into the so-called resource curse, which is a phenomenon which describes that countries that have a lot of valuable natural resources and whose economy, I mean, to a large extent depends on extraction and trade with natural resources, and these resources often are used to sustain authoritarian governments, or they are also often associated with civil conflicts, or civil wars, and also have some negative economic consequences, but I don't want to go into that. And then there are so many cases, I mean, sadly, like many African countries can be described in terms of resource curse. About Latin America today, I'm not so sure, some Southeast Asian countries as well. I don't know, Myanmar comes to my mind also. And of course, Saudi Arabia and its oil. I think it's really directly associated with the durability of highly unfree regime there. This is sadly the case that the redistribution of sovereignty after World War II, the equal right of sovereignty that was now allocated to all countries, and also that it came with an explicit and specific indication that it involves, ownership of natural resources, it didn't really improve the system that much, And so all the more it is important to subject the sovereignty to continuous critique, and to think about what makes the exercise of sovereignty just, what under what conditions can we say that sovereignty serves justice, and what are the criteria that we use to judge it, and how we identify the abuses of sovereignty, So, in my work, I'm one of the main arguments that I'm trying to make is that human rights still remain one of the most comprehensive set of norms how to judge a country, a government, you know, sovereignty. I mean, you can, I guess, in this context, you can use it interchangeably. Yeah, how to judge the, or we can say how to judge exercise of public power in terms of justice or injustice. Yeah, but I think human rights have to be understood in a very broad sense. Yeah, it's not just about liberal understanding that there has to be basic political rights and civil liberties in place, but it also has a lot to do with distributive implications that human rights have. Yeah, that certain you know, levels of welfare have to be seen as implication of human rights. So it's also about the resource governance in the broadest sense of, I don't know, transparency, accountability, about participation in decision making, about like knowing that the public knows what the state, what decisions the state makes, demanding information, and so on. But also with debates and some criteria about, I don't know, when a state decides to, I don't know, like today, for example, I can give you an example of Czech Republic, where I come from. Yeah. So Czech Republic, obviously has some, important, significant deposits of lithium. Yeah. This highly, you know, valued mineral today. So important for green transformation and so on. Yeah. So how, it's a question about like, how do we make sure that, you know, the decision about extraction, the kind of deal that Czech Republic will strike with some extractive company, because Czech Republic does not have like a technology to extract such mineral, and the financial terms of the deal, and in how far the public will be involved in it, how far we will, you know, we will judge the economic benefits against, I don't know, social and environmental impacts of the extraction. These are all important aspects of what I call, or what people call, resource governance. Yeah. And so it really has to in those, you know, many dimensions, it has to meet the demands of good resource governance. And I think still that human rights give us quite a few, you know, important ways how to define this good governance. Yeah. Including, I don't know, starting with like starting with the idea that the government has to have, you know, legitimacy, it has to be representative, and so on. But also, like, if you understand human rights in a broader sense, for example, if you recognize that right to clean environment, or whatever it's called, I would have to double check that. Yeah. A healthy environment, right to healthy environment, it's also an important human right, or right to water, and so on. Yeah, so this all, I think, helps us to have quite an expansive view of what good governance over resources demands.
Just because, only for a second, because I'm curious, are you optimistic in the case of the lithium in the Czech Republic? Does it look like it's going to be democratically? Yeah.
I mean, not so much. According to, for example, Freedom House, Czech Republic is a consolidated democracy. Yeah, so it's really in the club of the developed, you know, democratic countries. Not like Hungary or Poland, who are no longer, for example, they cannot be considered consolidated democracy. So it's a really like close to perfect, you know, democratic country. And yet, these kinds of decisions and these kinds of, aspects are not really, like, I think that the systems of good governance are not there. Yeah. If only, for example, I think that the contract that the government would have to make with some foreign company, yeah, the foreign investment deal, yeah, I think that wouldn't be accessible to public assessment. That's just one example. Yeah. This is, reasons why this is the case. I would have to look into that, but I think that we still, you know, have, even in democratic countries, we still have a long way to go to fully democratize resource governance, and we're not really there yet.
In his classical work about the capitalist world system, Immanuel Wallerstein described the world's economy, but also the different kinds of statehood, of sovereignty, of economic development in a really relational and integrated system in which a less sovereign statehood of a state in the economic periphery of the world is not just coincidence or historical product, but also functional for a specific role in the capitalist world system. And many aspects of what we describe in today's podcast is somehow also mentioned in this very comprehensive economic theory of Wallerstein. I wanted to ask if you see any possibilities to bring together this more economic perspective with your, I'd say more legal perspective on international law.
This is a really interesting question. I mean, I would have to think about that more deeply, but I think that at least on one level, I can answer that. I also think that Wallerstein's concept is very useful. I think it's a very useful sort of descriptive device which helps us understand how world is organized. And I think it has to do with a lot with natural resources. And I especially think that it has to do with the fact that natural resources are still such important sources of economic wealth for countries and societies. And I think it's wrong, yeah. And I think it's really the fact that this is the fact, yeah, that for many countries, extraction of natural resources is considered like one of those, you know, main ways how to increase, GDP and wealth and so on. It helps to perpetuate the kind of the system, yeah, because the extraction of natural resources themselves is usually the countries do not have economic means to do it, so they have to invite foreign investors to do it for them. They have to strike very inequitable deals with them. I mean, the terms of those deals are very asymmetrical, very non-reciprocal. It means that the countries are subject to very restrictive international arbitration system and, you know, all kinds of global commercial rules of the game and so on. Yeah. But it's a system that pretty much means that once you are a country that does not have, you know, enough technology and means to extract resources, then to process the resources, and then to produce something out of these resources, yeah, then the resources will have to be taken, extracted by someone else, taken also somewhere else, and then something is produced from those resources also somewhere else, yeah. So this is why, you know, this is why this explains why there are so many poor countries that are otherwise extremely rich in natural resources, like is the case of so many African countries, yeah, because they have to rely on those semi-peripheries or the centers, yeah, to take the value, you know, and bring the value somewhere else, yeah. So I think. I think the complexity of these systems of extraction of natural resources, yeah, the fact that you have someone, the extraction and the money and investment, and then something has to be produced, like, I don't know, if you have lithium, it's just, you know, like produce a battery out of a lithium then requires capital and technology, and if you don't have it, then like what is your lithium for, yeah, you have to sell it, yeah, and so it means that somebody else will create value out of it, yeah. So this the fact that we to such a large extent rely on natural resources, especially minerals, oil, and so on, yeah, I think helps to maintain this system of center, semi-periphery, and periphery, yeah. And I think so. One of the most important reforms, I think, is for states, nations, societies, really, like to think about creating economic wealth by other. You know, by other means, not relying on extraction of natural resources, which is environmentally harmful. It is extremely bad for climate change. It's socially harmful. It just mostly, in most cases, it just does not really even generate any economic wealth for the countries. Yeah. So yeah, I do find that useful, and I think that in the context of systems of processing and extraction of natural resources, it makes a lot of sense.
There is this classical argument of Hannah Arendt in which she claims that human rights are powerless or impotent as long as they are not enforced by a state, and that de facto there's just one human right, the right to be part of a political community who enforces and reinstates those human rights. What changed since Hannah Arendt's critique of the human rights? Is the critique still valid, or do we have to think differently about human rights today?
She made a very important point, and I think part of her critique of human rights is, to some extent or to a large extent, I'm afraid, still applicable to how human rights work. Yeah, I mean, she basically said, I mean, it's wonderful that we invented the international legal system of human rights where every single individual holds a human rights, but we still we didn't invent like a global system of enforcement of those human rights, and the enforcement of human rights really still only depends on willingness of states. Yeah, so this is a fundamental weakness. But on the other hand, like this was critique she made in the 50s, yeah, so it's been almost 60, 70 years since, and human rights system has expanded enormously I think, you know, we can make all kinds of judgments about human rights. Yeah, we can judge their effectiveness. We can judge their, like, progress or lack of progress. We can judge how, you know, effective they are and what all kinds of areas they impact. Yeah. So again, it's such a complexity. Yeah. And it's difficult to say, to characterize the whole human rights system with just one word. Like, for example, it's just really difficult to say whether it's effective, yeah, because we would have to a really, like, detailed analysis of which human rights and what does it mean to be effective and so on. But I think we can still agree, yeah, despite the fact that it's so hard to simply, like, just to simply characterize how human rights work in global world. Yeah, we can still agree that they are more influential than they were before, that we do have some limited, you know, systems of enforcement. Yeah, we have courts, we have regional systems of human rights. Like, for example, the Inter-American system of human rights is quite impressive in how it protects human rights in the region. It made significant progress on the protection of indigenous rights, yeah, and abuses of state power and the violation of indigenous rights in Latin America. We have now human rights to some extent, you know, they are part of the global, you know, trading. I mean, in a very limited sense, but yeah, still, they are part of the global system of I don't know, money lending, the international aid, and so on. Yes. So, in other words, I mean, the international relations also. Economic relations are to some extent influenced by human rights. Yeah, so I don't know. Just to give you an example. Yeah, and under Obama, the Obama administration adopted this Dodd-Frank Act, which basically was aimed to limit, at least, yeah, or prohibit trade with these blood commodities, yeah. So it was based. This was based on the on the judgment on the human rights judgments, yeah. It's like in the sense that the most egregious, most serious violations of human rights are reason enough, you know, for example, not to engage in trading relations with some commercial partners, for example. Yeah, I think this is also something that the current Lieferketten Gesetz in Germany is also trying to achieve, yeah, to just be more sensitive to human rights violations and to limit, yeah, commercial relations with countries or commercial partners where you know, the human rights, the most basic human rights, are just not secured. Yeah, so there are these you know, different imperfect, very imperfect, and very inconsistent, I admit, yeah, ways of how rights are made effective, yeah, that they are enforced, not just by governments in the sense that they protect human rights of their citizens, but also that countries care about human rights of others, yeah, and they try to eliminate the most serious human rights violations from the world politics in the broadest sense of the term, yeah, from economic relations, from diplomatic relations and so on. Yeah. So I think that, like, the world is really a different place than what Hannah Arendt saw. I mean, I will leave open to how much progress this is. I mean, I certainly think that there is some progress. It's very discontinuous. Yeah, it's always like, it seems to be always like, I don't know, one step forward, two steps back, or two steps forward and one step back. So and it's really marred by continuous I don't know, geopolitical conflicts and powerful economic interests. Of course, yes, this is true. Yeah, but overall, I think human rights did gain significance. And we have developed a system which applies them globally more effectively.
What I really admire is, like, starting either way, how you decide if it's progress or not, to get into the details and to, as you said in the beginning, to start from what is happening, not from those principles and then looking where are they, but what are the institutions, how do they work, how could they work better. I think we have to bring, like, a scholar on this development of the human rights just from a historical perspective on the podcast. I think this is extremely important,
and there are so many areas you have to look and like make sort of separate assessment for different areas. Like, for example, there are scholars who say, if you want to know about human rights and their impact, why don't you, for example, examine the language that the oppressed groups in the world use? Yeah, like, what language do they use to fight against whatever, exploitation, you know, domination, injustice, dispossession, and so on and so on. Yeah. And maybe you'll find out that this has really become a sort of universal language for marginalized, discriminated, and oppressed groups, how to even identify the evils, yeah, the evils of economic exploitation, the evils of violence, gender violence, for example, yeah. Failures of states to protect their interests, their economic, cultural interests, and so on. Yeah. So this would be just like one way how to establish, yeah, the impact. But it's just quite another thing to look at, like, how, I don't know, for example, World Bank or International Monetary Fund, how they, like, use and misuse human rights to, how they instrumentalize human rights for certain economic ends, for example, yeah, or how United States selectively applies the human rights to either, pursue their national interests or pursue more, liberal diplomacy in the world. Yeah, so it's really like it's a very pluralistic so many different areas where you have to look, and some sort of general judgment, I think, is a bit difficult to make.
Petra, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Yeah, no, it was a pleasure. I love what I'm researching about, and I get very passionate talking about it. So my pleasure.
This has been the 72nd episode of Das Neue Berlin. Thank you for listening. Please recommend our podcast to your friends. Leave us a comment and follow us on Twitter. And of course, tune in next time. Bye bye.